Okay, so open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians 11. If you do so, I'll remind you of an event that took place, I think it was in St. Paul, Minnesota, a couple months ago, during all that kind of stuff that was going on with ICE and the protests and things that were happening. It was kind of in the middle of January when a group of antagonistic protesters entered the city's church in St. Paul, sat through one service, probably a group of 20, 25, maybe 30 people. And then during the second service, they all stood up and shouting all different sorts of types of things and completely disrupted the service. It was rather, as the pastor of that church said, it was rather alarming, but it was utterly disgraceful. These protesters harassing and intimidating and being utterly disregarding of God's presence and the significance of His church gathering to worship Him. It was disgraceful. I think you probably heard news about this, and certain arrests have taken place as a result of it, but it was a massive disruption, one that we think should never happen ever again, but one that we could probably expect will happen more likely in the future. So it was a massive disruption to the worship of the church, worship of City's Church, in January of 2026. But what we see happening in these next few chapters in Corinth are massive disruptions that were occurring in the church in Corinth. However, these disruptions were not coming or not the result of antagonistic outsiders that were infiltrating the church to protest and harass and intimidate. These disruptions in the Corinthian church came from within. They were coming from the church's own members. Paul is going to work through three different sets of issues in chapters 11 through 14 that describe the types of disruptions that the church was facing in its worship. So these are different sets of issues. There are two issues in chapter 11, and there's a final issue, at least we could say it's one issue that has many tentacles in chapters 12 through 14. The chapters 12 through 14 address practices that arose in the church regarding the misuse of spiritual gifts. And the latter half of chapter 11 address the abuse of the Lord's Supper, of communion, that highlights a divide within the church between the rich and the poor. However, the first half of chapter 11 focuses in on what was occurring during the worship of the church, and it related to the relationship between men and women. And this is the disruption that we'll be looking about and learning about today. Now, before we actually get into the specifics, I want you to think about just the relevance of a passage like this. Obviously, the custom of wearing head coverings, something that we are not overtly like familiar with, but let me just point out a few things on what this passage actually touches on that is relevant to us. Some of these are simple questions, like, are there differences between men and women? Are there differences between men and women within the context of the church? And if so, how are these differences displayed? How do we recognize or embrace or display the unique differences in giftings, callings, and purposes of men and women in our practices? How do we recognize them? How do we support them? How do we follow them? How do we keep them? And maybe even more specifically, are those differences recognizable by how we dress? Can we point them out by looking at how people dress, so by what they wear or not wear, and perhaps even how we style our hair? So my contention is that there are differences. There are differences between men and women that are grounded in the very order, very nature, very purpose of God's creation. These differences continue even after the fall, and even in the church, which is the first fruits of God's new creation. So they're not only grounded in God's original creation, they are maintained and upheld in God's new creation. I think that's probably what is actually causing the disruption in the Corinthian church. They are going against nature and order, against God's original creational design. So when we look at 1 Corinthians 11, verses 2 through 16, I want you to just have a summary in your mind. What is the passage about? The passage is about honoring your head, honoring the authority that God has placed over you. Wives are to honor their head, their husbands, or men in general. Women in general are to honor men within the congregation. Husbands and men are to honor their head, who is Christ, just as Christ honored his head, who is God. So the message then, I think the summary of the text is this: honor your head so that God would be glorified in your worship. Now we recognize this is a challenging passage. We're going to approach it in two different ways. But first, I'd like to just kind of quickly run through the entire passage verse by verse, offering just kind of a short explanation of each verse so that we have the overall flow of argument in our minds, and we can actually just see what Paul is saying, right? We're basing this, we want to hear what God says. Before we kind of get to any sort of application, before we try to think about what does it actually mean, we first need to hear what he actually says. What is God actually saying in this text? So we're just dealing with common understanding and apprehension of the words of the passage. And once we've done that, I think we can kind of circle back around again and ask the questions that we all probably have. These aren't anything new, but the questions that we all have about the passage. What does it actually mean? Well, this is what God says. What does it actually mean? And what does it look like for us to embrace the meaning of the text? Not necessarily what the text says, but what the text means. And I think after we do this, we can have a solid grasp of what this passage is all about. So here, let's run through. Let me first just read it, and then we'll go back through again. So listen to the word of the Lord. 1 Corinthians 11, verse 2. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I deliver them to you. But I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ. The head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. For if a woman or if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but a woman is the glory of man. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. That is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. For a woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. If anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. Okay, so that's the text, that's the passage. And now let's kind of circle back around and kind of go through it just verse by verse. I'm going to read the verse. I'm going to try to just offer some brief explanation, keeping my words to a minimum. And then we'll come back and kind of ask some of those more significant questions. So verse 2. Now I commend you because you remember me in everything and maintain the traditions even as I deliver them to you. So Paul begins kind of in this way. It's quite surprising. It's not what we would expect. He begins by praising the Corinthians. As it pertains to their worship, they are holding to the traditions, to the teachings that have been passed on to them from Paul. So this doesn't seem to be a response that Paul is offering to their questions, which we've seen in the last few chapters. But Paul is now addressing different issues that they're facing. He first begins by praising them for holding to the traditions. This is surprising because we know in this text that he's actually going to correct some of their misapplication of those teachings and those traditions. And we know in the very next passage that he's going to directly say that he can't commend them, he can't praise them for what they're doing and how they're abusing the Lord's Supper. So verse 17 says that he does not commend them. And verse 22 says, or asks this question, shall I commend you in this? And he says, no, I will not. So even though Paul recognizes that they are holding to the traditions, the teachings that have been given to them, they still need correction. They've been faithful to a certain extent, but now they're off in several significant ways and need to correct course. So Paul is now going to do that as he addresses these topics. Now, verse 3, but I want you to understand that the head of every man is Christ, the head of a wife is her husband, and the head of Christ is God. Now this verse, verse 3, is foundational to everything that follows. All of the instructions that follow relate to how we either honor or dishonor our head. And there is a hierarchical structure to how this ought to work between men and women, between men and Christ, and between Christ and God. Paul is describing this structure. It's a structure of authority, which is what the word head means. Head means authority. So honor your head means to honor the authority that God has placed over you, which looks like this. Christ honors God, men honor Christ, and women or wives honor men or their husbands. So this structure, this hierarchical structure is going to be, it basically goes in both directions. It flows down from the Godhead to the rest of creation, and it flows up from the woman to the man, from the man to Christ, and from Christ to God. So it's cascading and flowing, or however you want to describe it. But that's the structure that Paul is alluding to here, describing here. Verse 4, this is where we get into it. Every man who prays or prophesies with his head covered dishonors his head. So Paul starts to provide his instruction. He's beginning his teaching now to correct the Corinthians. In the context of the worship gathering, men dishonor their head if they cover their heads while praying or prophesying. Now Paul uses the word head here in two different ways. It's a little bit of a play on words. He uses it to refer to the literal head of the man and the metaphorical head or his authority that's placed over him. So the man who covers his literal head while praying or prophesying dishonors his metaphorical head or authority, meaning he dishonors Christ. So in the context of the worship gathering, men are to pray with their heads uncovered so as to honor their head, Christ. Verse 5. But every wife who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonors her head, since it is the same as if her head were shaven. So Paul says the exact same thing about wives or women dishonoring their head. How do they dishonor their head? They dishonor their head when they pray with an uncovered head. So Paul is saying that they dishonor their head when they pray or prophesy with their head, their literal head, uncovered. So the takeaway at this point, if you're just simply what is Paul saying? Paul is saying that men are to pray or prophesy within the church as a part of the corporate worship gathering with their heads uncovered, and women are to pray or prophesy with their heads covered in order to avoid dishonoring their head. Men dishonoring Christ, and Christ or women dishonoring men. Now, Paul adds to this that a woman who prays or prophesies with her head uncovered is just like a woman who shaves her head. In other words, if you're not going to cover your head, then you might as well cut all your hair off. You might as go full G.I. Jane and just buzz it. Verse 6, for if a wife will not cover her head, then she should cut her hair short. But since it is disgraceful for a wife to cut off her hair or shave her head, let her cover her head. So this is an explanation of what Paul said at the end of the previous verse. If you're not going to cover your head, then cut your hair short. But you don't want to do that because it's disgraceful. Since it is disgraceful for a woman to cut her hair short and look like a man, or to shave her head, then she should cover her head. It seems like a little bit of a tangent, but we'll see that it's an important part of his argument. Men are to keep their heads uncovered. Women are to cover their heads. If they don't want to cover their heads, then they should cut their hair. But women shouldn't cut their hair, so they should just cover their heads. Verse 7. For a man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. Now this verse begins to unpack the reason for what Paul has instructed in verses 4 through 6. This verse begins to tell us why. Why this custom, why this practice, why men shouldn't cover their heads and women should. A man shouldn't cover his head because he is the image and glory of God. So Paul is reflecting back now on the creation story in Genesis 1, and he describes man, or Adam, as the image and glory of God. He's referring back to Genesis 1:26. Let us make man, Adam, in our image, after our likeness. This is interesting because in the next verse he says, so God created man, Adam, in his own image. In the image of God he created him, male and female, he created them. So both man and mankind consist of both sexes, male and female, and both are made in the image and likeness of God, according to Genesis 1:26 and 27. However, Paul is honing in on, he's focusing in on one part of this, which is God's creation of man. Where does he get this idea where men are the image, or man is the image and glory of God? He gets this from the next chapter. Paul follows this by saying that he gets this from Genesis 2. Now, Paul is going to say in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 7, that woman is the glory of man. So he's saying something different about men and women, but that doesn't contradict what is said about men and women in Genesis 1. Man is the image and glory of God, and woman is the glory of man. Now, where does Paul get this idea? And like I said, he gets this from Genesis 2, which he alludes to in verse 8. So verse 8 is this. For man was not made from woman, but woman from man. So man, don't cover your head, because you're the image and glory of God. Woman is the glory of man. Why? Or where do we get that from? Verse 8. Man was not made from woman, but woman from man. So he seems to be having this idea in mind, that the way that the man reflects the image, or is the image and glory of God, is because God created him directly, and he created him first. And then he used man to create the woman. The creation account in Genesis 2 emphasizes a different angle on the creation of the man and the woman. Adam was made first from the dust of the ground, the Adam from the Adamah, and God took a part of the man's side to make the woman. The man was made from dust, and the woman was made from man. Thus, the woman is the glory of man. She corresponds to the man. She helps us to see and understand what the man is like. She was created by him. She derives her existence from the man. She depends upon him. Verse 9. Neither was man created for woman, but woman for man. So look at those two ideas then, from man and for man. So Paul is highlighting here a creational distinctive according to the order, the nature, the design of God in bringing about the man and the woman. So this adds to what Paul is getting at from the creation account. The man wasn't created for the woman, but the woman was created for the man. The Lord provided the woman from the man, from his side, and for the man as a suitable helper, a compatible helpmeet to assist the man in carrying out his tasks. So the woman was created for the purpose of helping the man. She upholds this creational order, this design, this purpose of honoring him as her head, by covering her head. Verse 10, that is why a wife ought to have a symbol of authority on her head, because of the angels. Now, Paul's conclusion from the creation account is that women should have a symbol of authority. They should have authority on their heads, which represents the husband's authority over her. He adds another reason for this custom that seems to be completely out of nowhere, saying that women should have the symbol of authority on their heads because of the angels. So we'll come back and we'll address that, what that view is, or what it could possibly be. Verse 11. Nevertheless, in the Lord, woman is not independent of man, nor man of woman. This is one of those big buts that we see in Scripture. It helps to explain the mutual, even though the man was created first, and even though the woman was created for the man and from the man, that doesn't mean that the man has superiority over the woman. He has authority, but not superiority. The woman is not inferior to the man, and Paul is now countering this in verses 11 and 12. So this helps us to explain that both the man and the woman are mutually interdependent upon each other. Both the man and the woman have a dependence, a reliance upon each other. Going back to the original account of creation, the woman relies upon man in that she was made from the man and for the man. In every other subsequent creation, it's men that come from women. It's likely that Paul is countering any sort of misunderstanding we could have from the order or the design or the purpose of creation. He doesn't want the men in the congregation to let this get to their heads. No pun intended. They have authority that's grounded in the creation that women should recognize and submit to, but they also are dependent themselves on women, which is where he goes in the next verse. So they are to not think that they don't need women because the woman was made for the man and from the man. Verse 12 shows us that they actually depend completely upon women. For as woman was made from man, so man is now born of woman, and all things are from God. So God made the man first as a reflection of his image and glory. He then made the woman from the man as a helper for the man, as part of his good design. And God bestowed upon the woman the immense privileges of childbearing. As Adam named Eve, the mother of all living, and ever since then, every man that has entered this world comes from a woman. He has been born of a woman. This is God's design. Women dependent upon man, and men dependent upon women. Woman from the man, and man from the woman. Now, verse 13 presents like a summary, but also another appeal to a different sort of authority that says the same thing as creation. So verse 13, judge for yourselves, is it proper for a wife to pray to God with her head uncovered? Now, having grounded his argument in creation, Paul wants the Corinthians to decide for themselves, to come to his same conclusions about what is proper among men and women in their relationships within the church. They are to weigh his arguments out with the hope that they will come to the same conclusion as him. He wants them to see that it is not proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered. Verse 14, the appeal to nature. Does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? So in order to persuade the Corinthians, Paul makes a final appeal to nature. His point seems to be that nature shows us the same point as the creation account. Nature shows us that long hair on men is a disgrace. It is shameful or dishonoring to him. Verse 15, but if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. So nature shows us that it is a disgrace for men to have long hair, but for a woman to have long hair, that is her glory. Not only is long hair her glory, it is given to her as a covering. Verse 16, if anyone is inclined to be contentious, we have no such practice, nor do the churches of God. So this verse here, this final verse in the passage, is clarifying. Apparently there were some in Corinth who were resisting this custom. They were fighting against it. They were being contentious. Paul saying that they were resisting the idea that it's appropriate and necessary for women to cover their heads when praying or prophesying. Paul warns them against contentiousness. And he states clearly that this is the custom, not just of the church in Corinth, but of all the churches. All the churches are under God through salvation in Christ and ought to reflect that reality in how they worship together as men and women. All right. How are we doing? Confused? Yeah. I'm going to sum it up for you. Here is my attempt to kind of understand or explain, summarize what Paul is saying here. So now that we've walked through the passage, let's attempt a summary. There's a structure of authority between men, women, Christ, and God that is woven into the very fabric of reality. This is how the world is. This is how the world has been made. This is how God has made the world. Now we can refer to this structure of authority as headship. God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man. Man is the head of woman. This structure flows from the very nature of God, in whom the Son is subordinate to the Father. The Son submits to the Father. The Father, God, is the head of Christ. This is merely functional. I'm going to use terms here that theologians use. This is a functional subordination, meaning he's subordinate to the Father in his role as the Son. It is not an ontological subordination, which means it is not a part of his essence or his being. He is co-eternal, co-equal in his essence with the Father, and yet in his role as the Son, he submits to the Father. So they are the same being, sharing the same divine qualities and essences and characteristics, but they have different roles. Now, this is important when we consider the relationship between men and women, because the same point is true in regards to how men and women relate to one another. They have a functional subordination. Women submit to men, wives submit to husbands, but they have equality within the presence of God as his image bearers, and quality in terms of how they benefit from Christ's redemption. So the structure of headship then is reflected in the order, design, purpose, nature of God's creation of the man and woman in Genesis 1 and 2, and is not a result of the fall in Genesis 3. And this authority structure, this principle of headship, continues even in the way men and women relate to one another and to God within the church. So we're, in one sense, we're recovering what has been lost through the fall. This is how God has made things. This is how God has designed men and women. There's order. There's design. There's a nature to it. He's created them differently, but he's given them different roles and responsibilities, and that continues even in the church. The particular way that the early church demonstrated submission to this principle of headship is by covering or not covering one's head while praying or prophesying, while speaking to God or speaking for God in the church. So men are not to cover their heads, and women are to cover their heads. This practice is reinforced by nature, which tells us that men are to look like men, and women are given the beauty and greatness of long hair, which is their glory. Okay, so that kind of a brief summary of what I think Paul is saying in this passage, giving us a structural design of creation between men and women and how they relate and how they ought to act toward one another within the context of the church. So let's take some time now to ask some questions with hope that we can kind of shed more light on what this passage might actually mean for us. So I have 5 questions there on the bulletin, 5 questions that we'll go through, even though there's probably a number of questions that we won't get to that you might have. We'll at least tackle these, and then we can, on Wednesday, we can discuss more, or if you have more questions, you can ask me after the service. We're not going to be able to get to everything, obviously. Let's first begin by just simply thinking about what a head covering is. What is a covering? What does Paul have in mind? As you can probably guess, not everyone agrees on what the head covering worn in the first century was. There's basically 3 options from what I can tell. The first one is the woman's hair itself. Paul says the woman's hair, her glory, is given to her as a covering in verse 15. So some interpreters would then see this covering that's mentioned in verse 15, referring to the woman's hair, as a sign, or as the covering itself. So when he's talking about a woman covering her head, he's talking about her having her hair probably done up in some particular way, maybe put in a bun, maybe, how was this, say, corralled? I mean, you guys corral your hair? You just don't let it go free-flowing and long and laid out like that. So it's probably addressing some sort, the way that they interpret it is probably addressing some sort of hair style, not just the hair itself. However, I don't think that this is likely, because it doesn't seem, it seems like Paul could get to this point much easier if he simply says the woman's hair is her covering, and just kind of left it at that. But I think what he's getting at in verse 15 is slightly different. So it's unlikely, it doesn't explain Paul's teaching about women having a covering on their heads in verses 5 and 6, which seems to be the full brunt of his teaching. So if Paul had hair in mind the whole time, then he could have just said so. A second option is to see the head covering as a veil, something that would not only cover a woman's head, but her face. We know that this was a custom in the ancient East. We know that it's a custom in some cultures today. Most translations use the language of covering, but some use the language of veiling or unveiling. So this could imply that the covering was more than just something that covered the back of the head, but it also raises questions about contemporary application. Most people, as far as I know, would not be in favor, even if they're in favor of head coverings, would not be in favor of wearing a veil. So the third option sees the covering as a shawl or a scarf or maybe contemporary practices, a hat, something that women wear on top of their heads and flows down the back of their head over their hair. Just for the sake of the argument, we'll assume that this is this or something similar is what Paul has in mind. So a head covering, then, is some sort of thin cloth-like material that covered a woman's head and her hair, like a shawl or a scarf. So let's get to the next question, which I think is probably the most important, or one of the most important. Why are women to cover their heads? Why this practice? We know that Paul says it's about them honoring or not shaming or not dishonoring their head, their husband, or the men in the congregation. So why this teaching? A better question might be this. What was a woman communicating by not covering her head? If she refused to cover her head, what was she saying? What was being communicated through that action, through her refusal to cover her head? I think this question gets to the heart of the matter. So Paul's teaching is that a woman who prayed or prophesied with an uncovered head dishonored or shamed her head. That's what he says. Either her husband or the other men of the congregation. Now, in some cultures, a woman who would cover her head in social settings as an indication that she was married. So it was a sign of respect and honor to her husband that she wore outside of the house. That would be a sign to everyone else that she was devoted to her husband, dedicated to him, and living in an upright and kind of chaste manner. She was living modestly, and she was submitting to her husband. So it was a sign of her submission to her authority, to her head. This is how she showed her husband honor in different social settings. And I think that's what people... if people understand Paul to be addressing the relationship between husbands and wives, then they're going to appeal to that kind of understanding. So in that culture, for a woman to wear a head covering shows that she's submissive to her husband. So for her to take off that head covering, even in the context of the church, which means that she's releasing herself from her binds to her husband. She's showing that she is free from her covenantal obligations to her marriage. There also seems to be some evidence that an uncovered woman communicated that she was available to marry. So she's saying one thing by not covering her head. She's telling the men to pursue her. She's saying that she is free. She is able to be pursued. Possibly that she was even promiscuous. And some have suggested as well that short hair on a woman identified her as a prostitute or someone who had been disgraced through the public shaming ritual of shaving her head because of her adultery. So if someone committed some sort of, if she broke her marital vows, or if she was offering herself to others for money, then she would cut her hair short so that that message could be communicated. There's scholars debate about the evidence for that particular interpretation. Now, it's possible that Paul is merely concerned with this type of shameful behavior. He wants the women in the congregation to avoid anything that would bring shame or disgrace upon the congregation, upon the worship of God together. So he wants them to avoid what would have been understood in their context and their culture as being sort of defiant feministic attempts to overthrow their submission to their husbands or to the other men within the congregation. It was a way for women to assert their superior status, their free status now, whether they see that in Christ or just in Roman culture in general. So Paul wants them to avoid joining in any sort of early kind of feministic practices that were all about women asserting their power and flaunting their freedom and independence by not wearing head coverings in public. And this is the same type of thing that we see happening in our day or in the past. What happens then when people want to show their freedom or to show their liberation? They throw off the traditions, whatever those traditions might be. If it's Woodstock, they take off their clothes and slide around in the mud and listen to music for days on end, high on drugs. You know, if it's other sorts of behavior like that, they're saying we're free, we're liberated, now we can actually act because these things, these traditions, these cultural expectations are so confining and restricting to us. So Paul is recognizing that there were some in Corinth who are wanting to do these very same things or to participate in these very same things. And Paul is saying, no, we uphold the traditions. There's men, there's women, there's a proper way for them to worship God together, and they ought to do this as a matter of precedence for the rest of the churches. So that behavior, whatever it might have been, could have communicated then that they were dishonoring to men or to husbands. They were disruptive to the proper worship of God. They were diverging from the order and design and purpose of creation. But I think there's more to it than that. Paul points out that it was also an attempt to make man a focus of worship. I think this is what he's getting at in these weird verses about the glory of God and the glory of man. He says in verse 7, "A man ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God. But a woman is the glory of man." If a man were to cover or veil his head in worship, then not only would he be acting like the pagan priests who covered their heads with their togas when praying and offering sacrifices, he would also be covering or veiling his head as the image and glory of God. He would be concealing what God has declared and designed to be glorious. And that's it, exactly what worship is. Worship is about the glory of God. So for a man to cover his head, he would be concealing or hiding the glory of God. For a woman who is the glory of man, to uncover or unveil her head, she would be drawing attention to the glory of man, which is not what we do in worship. We want to avoid glorifying man in worship. Therefore, a woman ought to cover her head. Worship is not about the glory of man, but about the glory of God. Therefore, a man should worship God with an uncovered head, and a woman should worship God with a covered head. Women are to pray and prophesy without covering their heads, which brings shame upon their head, their husband, or the other men, and it draws unnecessary and unwarranted attention upon man's glory. It is a way for man to assert himself into the worship of God. Okay, next question. Is this referring to men and women in general or to husbands and wives specifically? That was interesting. I don't know what Bible you have, but if you have something other than the ESV, it's going to be inconsistent in how it translates these two words. women, men, wife, husband. Actually, it's not even going to mention a wife or a husband. The ESV provides a footnote to the words wife and husband in verse 3. Now, the Greek word, this is kind of the summary, the Greek word for wife and the Greek word for husband, they are the same. These words can refer either to a husband or a man or a woman and or a wife, depending upon the context. Now, you can see then how the ESV alternates in how it translates these words, translating them as wife and husband in verse 3, verse 5, verse 6, and verse 10, but as man or woman in verse 4, verse 7, verse 8, verse 9, verse 11, verse 12, verse 14, verse 15. Somewhat confusing, it makes it seem like head coverings are appropriate for married women. So if you read it just strictly from what the ESV is saying, he says in the context of the corporate worship gathering, when husbands, if you're married and you come together in the context of this setting and you pray or prophesy to God, then you are to cover your head out of respect and honor for your husband. Now, that would open up the door in terms of how you would apply that to people who are not married or to people who have been married but have lost a spouse. There's all sorts of implications then in how you understand and apply the point that Paul is making here. Now, this may be, in fact, how it should be interpreted. Now, it's interesting to me that none of the other translations translate it this way. The ESV is unique in this fact. There seems to be some reasons for doing that, which obviously they would have if they're translating and making that sort of move to be different than the rest of the other translations. The other translations could just leave it general and leave it up to the interpreter to decide whether or not it's referring to husbands and wives or men and women. It seems to me, though, that Paul, what he has in mind here is more general and more broader than just married couples. Even though his appeal to creation is an appeal to the first married couple in the Bible, they also are creational truths that transcend just marriages. This is how men and women are to relate to one another in every setting. Within the context of the church, that's why we have male leadership. In the context of the family, that's why we have male headship. So he's saying that this is a principle that's from the created order that applies in every aspect and area of life. So these are creational, natural truths that transcend time and culture and speak to who we are as men and women. It's always appropriate for us to conduct ourselves in ways that speak to who God created us to be. So headship doesn't just apply to marriage. It flows from the Godhead into the rest of his creation. Husbands and wives, the fathers and children, the very leadership model of the church. Men bear the authority and the responsibility for their wives, their families, the church, and society by and large. So to put it another way, I think if we follow Paul's logic here, and this is what he's getting at, it would be shameful then for an unmarried, divorced, or widowed woman to pray or prophesy in the church with an uncovered head. That is a dismissal of the submission that they ought to have in giving honor to their head. Okay, two more questions. What does this have to do with angels? And then we'll get to the practice. Is this binding on us today? So what does it have to do with angels? So for the most part, our questions have addressed what does it look like in the context of the church. Now, Paul adds to this, like we saw in verse 10, a phrase, a little clause that's caused lots of speculation. This ought to happen, not just because of men and women, not just because of honoring or dishonoring heads, but it should happen because of the angels. Women ought to have authority on their heads because of the angels. Now, what is he actually getting at here? Let me give you some examples. Or some options. Some see this reason as a reference to human messengers, not spiritual beings. So this is a little bit of how we interpret and understand the Greek word angelos, which is a word that can mean messengers or it can mean angels. It's the same word, and again, it goes back to how you translate this word in its context. It's interesting to me that the ESV, though it translates this word as angels, gives us a footnote that says, or messengers. So this is an option, even though I don't think it's a very likely option. Paul, if we just simply go by the way he's used this word in this letter, he's speaking of spiritual beings, not human messengers. So women are to have this sign, this symbol of authority on their head, not because of other human messengers that might happen to pop in on the church one Sunday morning and visit you, but because of spiritual beings. Now, some see this covering then as necessary so as to not attract the angels, meaning the fallen angels. In this view, Paul is alluding to Genesis 6, where the sons of God, a reference to fallen angels, saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and took them for their wives. Well, that's an option. Wear the covering over your head so that you don't attract angels. A third view is that this reason is given so that the church would not offend the angels. They would maintain the order, the structure of God's creation. The sons of God or the sons of men being made a little lower than the angels. There's a hierarchical structure that is Paul is alluding to that goes beyond just simply that of between men and women and men and Christ and God. Paul is inserting the angels into this structure as well. The mankind being made a little lower than the heavenly beings, as Psalm 8 describes. So this view then is that the church ought to have this practice because it maintains God's created order. It witnesses to the glory of God in creation as it's being displayed in proper worship, the worship of the church. The angels then, who can expect the church to act within God's creational design and order, and not to assert themselves over over other authorities. So what do we make of this? The first view, I don't think it's very likely. Paul's references to the angels, like I said in this letter, are to spiritual beings, not other human messengers. If we're simply basing it off of that fact, it seems to not fit the context. The second view is plausible, that this refers to fallen spiritual beings that may have an interest or may be attracted to women, so you want to cover yourselves, even though it's strange and creepy. I don't think you think about this often enough. Cover your head so that the fallen angels don't find you attractive and want to take you as their wives. Now that, I know women worry about a lot of things, but that would be something that would be a lot to worry about. And it doesn't seem to fit either with the things that they're doing within the church. When are you to cover your head? When you pray or prophesy. So you're not attractive if you're not praying and prophesying. Like I don't know exactly how to take that, but it doesn't seem to be the way that we should take it, even though I'll hold out that it's possible. I think the third view is plausible as well. We know that angels are interested in the things of salvation, right? Things into which they long to look, as Peter says. We know that God's manifold wisdom is revealed in the church to the spiritual beings in the heavenly places, Ephesians 3:10. We know that they're familiar with spiritual beings rebelling against God's created order, so they would have known what rebellion actually looks like because their fellow angels rebelled against the Most High and were thrown down. So it would seem then that they would have a desire or an interest in orderly worship and how God's created beings, his men and his women, his image bearers, actually order and maintain that order within their worship together as men and women. It seems to fit better, I think, in the context, but I could possibly change my mind down the road. I don't think we can land definitively on any of these. I can't be 100% certain. Paul doesn't provide any sort of explanation of what he's getting at, so we have to kind of fill in the gaps. Now, I would, however, just caution against fixating on this and encourage us to focus on the main point of the passage, which is about honoring your head. So now, finally, is the practice of wearing a head covering binding on the church today? Now, let's just reflect on this for a moment, because this will help us, I think about application too. There's been a bit of a resurgence of wearing head coverings in some circles. So I know for some of you, this is a question that you've had. In order to answer this question, though, we have to answer another question, and that's this. Does the wearing of a head covering or the lack thereof, in our culture communicate the same meaning as it did in the Greco-Roman world of the first century? Or are there other ways that better communicate the meaning of submission to and honoring of our respective heads in today's world? So the question is this: does God require the covering itself, or what the covering shows or means or communicates? Is it the form that matters, or does the form depend upon the cultural meaning we assign to it? So I think those are the questions that's kind of driving me to provide an answer. And I think, just to cut to the point, I don't think that the wearing of head coverings is binding on the church today. Rather, I think that the principle that the covering undergirded the church in the church in the first century is completely binding on the church today, which is that there should be this appropriate headship and recognition of headship within the context of the church, between men and women, between how we relate to one another, and how we actually display our masculinity or our femininity. So there's little doubt that this plays a major role in deciding the answer and how we answer those questions that I was asking, whether it's the form or whether it's what the form communicates. So proponents of head covering say that it is the form that matters. We can't simply dismiss this because this is what Paul is saying to the churches, and it was a custom of all the churches. Wearing the head covering matters when praying or prophesying, or not wearing the head covering matters when praying or prophesying for men. Especially in our culture, where traditional customs related to the differences between men and women are so quickly discarded. We could see this happening rapidly within our society. So it would seem then that at least the proponents of wearing head coverings are going to appeal to what's happening within our culture and saying, see, this is the reason why we need to recover the practice of head coverings. Can't you see that what's happening in the culture, which is a symptom of what's happening in the church, needs to be recovered? And I would say yes and amen to what's happening within the culture of the church and what's happening within the culture at large. But I don't think that simply implementing this practice is going to restore or fix the problem. Now they would say, the proponents would say, that the church needs to hold the line, resist feminism, maintain the design, order, and purpose of creation. And in their mind, one way to do that is to bring these head coverings back, to be obedient to what they see Scripture saying, bring the head coverings back because it's a sign of men's headship, of men's authority in the home and in the church. Now, it's interesting, too. They would even point to the practice of men removing their hats when they enter a building or before prayer as evidence of a wide cultural adoption of this teaching. Now, where does that come from? I noticed Jeff, when he came in this morning, he was wearing a beanie, but when he came up to pray, he wasn't wearing a beanie. So we do this culturally, at least men do this culturally, when we pray or when we say the Pledge of Allegiance or when we hear our national anthem. So there's a recognition then that at least in that, at least that part, there seems to be a still an awareness of this practice or wherever this practice came from. Now, without succumbing to the equally damaging tendency toward Gnosticism, which where forms don't matter and everything is just spiritualized, I want to gently push back against the form. I don't think head coverings in our culture communicate the meaning they did in the first century. If a random citizen sees a woman cover her head while praying or prophesying in public, they're probably not going to think, oh, she's honoring those in authority over her and wearing that for the angels. That's probably not going to be what the person thinks. But if a woman dresses like a man, if she refuses to take her husband's last name, or refuses to wear a wedding ring and dresses seductively, and she insists on her right to pray and prophesy in the church, then I think that it's safe to say that those types of forms, those actions and behaviors, even what she dresses, communicate something. She is saying that she wants to free herself from the creational order of things and has swallowed the feminist bait, hook, line, and sinker. I find it ironic that the symbol that some of, I don't know why I thought of this, but the symbol that some women use to celebrate their so-called reproductive freedom in marches several years ago was pink hats. Pink hats with cat ears, or even pink uteruses complete with two ovaries. Now that covering, interestingly enough, that symbol that they put on their heads was a sign of their rebellion against the patriarchy and so-called rights to reproductive freedom. So you can see then how different symbols and signs can communicate different things. Whether it's wearing a hat, or it's wearing a hat that symbolizes something completely different. I'm going to mention one more point on the question of forms. This is just another parallel example, I think, that says that we don't have to necessarily embrace the form to follow the teaching, follow the meaning. So we have clear, undisputed teaching from Jesus about washing one another's feet, and yet we recognize that Jesus is getting at something more than just this simple form of humble service. But Jesus speaks clearly to his disciples in John 13. If I have then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you also should do just as I have done to you. Now that seems to be pretty clear, pretty straightforward. Yet I don't hear anyone advocating for feet washing to occur in our culture today. And we do this because I think we recognize that as washing someone's feet in that culture was a culturally bound practice reserved for the lowest of the low, for household slaves, and that Jesus was actually telling his disciples and showing his disciples the type of humble service that they ought to have toward one another. By washing his disciples' feet, Jesus was showing them how they ought to humbly serve and honor each other in every way, not merely in this one particular way. It's not simply a matter of following the form. Jesus wants us to show this type of service always toward one another. The form of service then is broadened to include all of our interactions with one another. I think that's what's happening here with head coverings. They don't seem to carry the same meaning that they did in the first century. Therefore, we should adopt similar things that say similar things about what the meaning was in our day and age. So where does that leave us then? Let me summarize real quickly. I'll give you some things to think about. Worship should be about the glory of God, not the glory of man. So when we come into worship, we are to dress appropriately according to our sex, and we are to do so in a way that directs our attention to glorify God. We are meeting with the living God, praising and declaring His glory and proclaiming His greatness. It shouldn't be to draw attention to ourselves, either by dressing like a slob or by dressing like somebody who wants attention. It should be designed to be respectful of the one that we come together to worship. Structures of authority or headship are biblical concepts that flow from the Godhead to the church and the family. When we think about the nature of things, the nature of God's creation, we see it first in the being of God. This is how the Father and the Son relate to one another. They both have these different roles, and that carries itself down to how God has made men and women, and how we are to interact with one another in our families and in our church. So that structure, that authority, or that headship then is a biblical concept that we must cling to at all costs. Headship is also a creational reality that's grounded in God's design, His order, His purpose for creation. He has made men and women differently for different purposes, and He wants that actually to be maintained in how we act toward one another. Headship is to be upheld by the men and women of the church and how they maintain the distinctions that exist between the sexes in culturally appropriate and traditional ways. So men are to act and dress like men. They are to be biblically masculine. Women are to act and dress like women. They are to be biblically feminine. Now, are there a variety of different ways that could be understood and applied? Yes. Now, is culture going to say that it has a big part in how that actually gets fleshed out and understood? Yes. But at a minimum, this is what we are aiming for. So this is how God has designed us and how He has created us. And within the context of the church, this is how we ought to practice it with one another, in order that in all things God would be glorified. Soli Deo Gloria. To God be the glory alone. Let's pray.